You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. With pressure mounting on both sides of the Atlantic for full public disclosure of U.S. and U.K. intelligence leading up to the war in Iraq, British Prime Minister Tony Blair fielded questions from the House of Commons yesterday in London. Earlier this week, British Foreign Secretary Jack Straw admitted to the Commons that the February weapons dossier, which Colin Powell quoted at the U.N., should never have been published. The so-called dodgy dossier, lifted from a doctoral student's dissertation from 12 years ago, was the centerpiece of the shaky evidence that now threatens to bring down Tony Blair's entire cabinet. Speaking before Parliament, Blair described the scale of the occupation and admitted that while the security and stability of Iraq is slowly improving, it still has a long way to go.
There are some 14,000 British troops in theatre, 10,000 in Iraq. We're also now bringing in forces from other countries as well. Indeed, over the next few weeks, round about 19 or 20 different countries will be participating. So we are trying to make sure that at every level we have the troop requirements that we need. But should they require more troops, of course, we will make sure that those troops are available.
What timescale does he envisage in general for the restoration of order in Iraq now and perhaps the eventual return of British troops?
Exactly when those troops can come home, I cannot be sure. It is still obviously serious because at the present time there are groups, former Ba'athist elements, that are trying to regroup and may pose a threat to our forces and particularly to the American forces in Baghdad. However, I think it is also fair to say that as a result of the work that's being done by British troops, American troops and others inside Iraq, there are, for example, in Basra now, a couple of thousand civilian policemen that are back patrolling the streets. There are many of these towns that have now reinstituted proper political local councils. There are real problems, but there are also real improvements.
British Prime Minister Tony Blair speaking yesterday before the House of Commons in London. Three American soldiers were killed and eight were injured today in a series of attacks south of Baghdad. Meanwhile, investigations continued into the deaths of six British troops killed on Monday, the largest casualty since the occupation began. Peace Watch correspondent Robert Knight has more.
Details emerged slowly this week about Tuesday's local uprising in the Iraqi town of Majar al-Kabir, which resulted in the deaths of six British Royal Marines and injuries to at least eight more involved in subsequent rescue efforts, the greatest British loss of life since the occupation began. The Times of London is calling the event an execution today, even though most British papers say the complete sequence of events remains unclear. Others on the scene say the uprising was primed by intrusive weapon searches and triggered when the British soldiers fired on a Muslim crowd incensed at the intrusion of unclean dogs sniffing around their holy places. British journalist and retired parliamentarian Tony Benn had this perspective from London today.
My understanding of it is that the British forces involved were engaged in searches which were very aggressive, going into people's houses, apparently taking dogs in, sniffer dogs, which is a tremendous offence in the Muslim mind that an animal comes into your house, and searching through women's underwear and things that created great religious offence. And so they protested. The British returned with plastic bullets, and the Iraqis then open fire with weapons that must be available all over the country, and that's where the deaths occurred.
In a national address carried by the BBC, British Defense Secretary Geoffrey Hoone attributed the conflict to what he perceives as cultural differences between Iraqis and their colonizers.
Unlike our society, people there routinely carry really quite heavy weapons. I find it disturbing to discover that people carrying machine guns is not that unusual. But I'm afraid that is the case. This is a highly militarized society, and people are very reluctant to give up their weapons.
But Tony Benn sees the current Anglo-Iraqi antagonism as having deeper historical roots.
And remember, when the British Army went into Iraq in 1920, after the Ottoman Empire, the British general said, "We've come to liberate you." When Napoleon went to Egypt in 1803 and conquered it, he said, "I've come to liberate you." Liberation is the word of all imperial conquerors. And it just didn't correspond with the real situation. Actually, when the troops got there, they found that although many people in Iraq hated Saddam because he was a brutal dictator, they don't want to be occupied and made a colony of the United States with a few British troops in Basra. And so now you're facing a situation, we are both of us facing a situation where It's either the Intifada-type situation where Sharon, however tough he is, can't stop suicide bombers, or it could be more serious, it could be a sort of long-term Vietnam situation where, in order to retain control, search and destroy missions have to be undertaken, which will deeply embitter the Iraqis and make it impossible for the problems to be solved.
Bin, a retired member of the House of Commons, had dealings with Iraqi President Saddam Hussein during the first Gulf War, when Bin prevailed upon Hussein to release hostages from the United Kingdom prior to the outbreak of that war. Then, in February 2003, Bin conducted an exclusive interview with Hussein, who denied having weapons of mass destruction or links to al-Qaeda.
Looking back on it, though, don't mistake me, Saddam is a brute. I mean, I've said this in the House of Commons, and he knows my view. But I think his answer to my questions were fairly straightforward, and I think that he knew the war was coming. I asked him before the interview, do you think the war is inevitable? And he said, it is in the hands of Allah. Well, I said, I don't believe Allah is planning to attack Iraq. It's an American attack. But that was his argument. And I think that he knew it was coming.
It was in that interview that Hussein made comments relevant to today's crisis between Iraqi citizens and British occupation troops.
We say to the British people that Iraqis do not hate the British people. Before 1991, Iraq and Britain had a normal relationship, as well as a normal relationship with America. We hope the British people would tell those who hate the Iraqis and wish them harm that there is no reason to justify this war. And please tell them that I say to you, because the British people are brave, tell them that the Iraqis are brave too. Tell the British people, if the Iraqis are subjected to aggression or humiliation, they would fight bravely, just as the British people did in the Second World War. We will defend our country as they defended their country, each in their own way. The Iraqis don't wish war, but if war is imposed upon them, if they are attacked and insulted, they will defend themselves. They will defend their country, their sovereignty, and their security.
Saddam Hussein speaking with former British parliamentarian Tony Benn in February of 2003. In New York, I'm Robert Knight for Peace Watch.
A formal ceasefire announcement is expected before the arrival of a senior U.S. envoy this weekend, Palestinian officials said today, after securing a commitment from Islamic militants to halt attacks on Israelis for 3 months. Despite the emerging deal, violence continued. Israeli troops intercepted 4 Palestinians carrying 2 backpacks stuffed with explosives, killing 2 in a clash and capturing 2. Earlier, a Palestinian teenager shot and killed an Israeli phone technician near the West Bank before being seriously wounded by a security guard. A militia linked to Arafat's Fatah movement claimed responsibility. Yesterday, an Israeli helicopter fired on the car of a Hamas activist, killing 2 people in the car behind him, according to CNN News, and wounding 17 others. A truce might help end the violence, a necessary prelude to the U.S.-backed roadmap plan aimed at establishing a Palestinian state by 2005. The plan requires the Palestinians to break up the armed groups, but Palestinian Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas has ruled out using force for fear of civil war. Mitch Potter is a reporter for the Toronto Star in Gaza City. He spoke with Peace Watch yesterday about his interview the night before with a senior Hamas deputy who said, quote, "Let us dispose with the rhetoric and be realistic. Israel will never be defeated. Our goal must be for the creation of a Palestinian state alongside Israel," end quote. In our conversation today with Potter, he discusses what could be required of the Bush administration to advance the prospects of peace between Palestine and Israel.
It has to push like it's never pushed before. And quite frankly, for the first half of his presidency, George Bush managed to avoid this conflict. I think he saw in his predecessors a quagmire that he didn't want to get messed in. He actually made a statement on behalf of his government that was unprecedented. To be here at the very beginning as he was, really, he committed himself to a real push. And there's an expectation that follows that say what you will about the post-war era in Iraq, but there is a lot at stake in the Middle East for the U.S. administration
I wanted to say that you're saying what Bush needs to do is push. It sounds like he's pushing the Palestinians. I mean, when he's making statements calling the Palestinian militants an enemy of peace, I would think he needs to push both sides.
Mm-hmm.
What's your assessment?
Well, that's what just about every Palestinian you'll ever find will tell you. They're really enraged that a great many Palestinians feel that they were the ones that agreed to the roadmap peace plan as drawn by the U.S. administration. Israel is the party that refused to accept the roadmap as written and only now agrees to it on 14 conditions that have kind of been sitting on the shoulder of the whole thing. So the Palestinians are saying, we say yes, what's the problem? We're ready. And yet the pressure is being applied on Palestinian militant groups. So there's a sense in the region amongst Palestinians that only one half of the equation is really being pressed hard. But again, dovetailing with the U.S. war on terror, Hamas has presented itself with suicide bombings as, I suppose, an irresistible target. It's really, you don't have to think very hard in this region to understand that although both sides, in my opinion, have a lot to answer for, there is no excuse for suicide bombs. There's no justification for it. And as long as they continue, I think we can expect the Bush administration to focus on that first and foremost. If Hamas delivers the ceasefire as promised, I think the coin can be turned over. And then so many people have doubts as to whether Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon is really serious about this. He's the man who built the settlement project. He is the father of the settlements in the West Bank and Gaza. Does he really want to withdraw them and allow a Palestinian state to happen? Well, if this ceasefire happens, we're about to find out the answer to that. I believe the answer will come because of pressure from the Bush administration.
I think that with regard to the suicide bombings, certainly they are reprehensible. But I would also add that the actions on the part of the Israeli government are equally as reprehensible.
You know, I'm trying to get a sense of what kind of resonance Hamas has on the streets of Gaza. You're reminded that the kill ratio, as horrible as it is to count numbers, is still at about 3-1, three Palestinians dead for every Israeli dead. And when you look at the number of civilian deaths, there are a lot more dead Palestinian civilians in this region over the past 33 months than there are Israelis. Mm-hmm. The Israeli answer to that is, fine, we regret it. We don't intend to kill civilians, unlike Palestinian suicide bombers who clearly do. But when you do the math and you realize that when things like one-ton bombs drop on Hamas militants and kill more than a dozen people, that response becomes weak.
Yes, indeed. If you don't you don't intend to kill civilians, then you don't drop bombs where civilians are living. At any rate, Mitch Potter, we thank you so much for your perspective. Any final thoughts on your part?
Well, as they say in the Arab world, inshallah, God willing, the suffering I can't tell you on the streets of Gaza is so acute. And speaking to one of a United Nations refugee relief organization, the senior men, you know, they made an appeal for over $90 million at the beginning of this year. They've barely received a third of it. Now, I don't know what you think about the UN, but this particular branch of the UN only receives donations from donor countries. They don't have regular funding. So at the very time when the need becomes more and more acute, I think, again, the Groundhog Day dynamic here, people are becoming fatigued with seeing these images on their TV. They're not holding on to this story the way they may otherwise have a year or two ago, and they're also not reaching into their pockets the way they might have a year or two ago. And so the desperation of what you're seeing in Gaza is heartbreaking.
You've seen some of these scenes?
Yes.
In Gaza?
Yes, it's worse in the south of Gaza, but it's really in all directions. You have to think what a compressed place this is with a fence built around it. 1.2 million Palestinians living in this zone. And, you know, unemployment peaks a little bit and drops a little bit, but for the most part, it's running at more than 50%. An enormous number of people are living strictly on humanitarian relief and nothing else. People have sold everything that can be sold over the past 33 months. families have sold jewelry, they've sold gold, they've sold everything that has value, and they've borrowed everything they can from friends and relatives. They're literally down to nothing now. And that's why the need is more acute than it ever has been.
And what is the average day like for a Palestinian living in that environment?
Drudgery and boredom is a kind of sick dynamic of it. Yesterday I was in Beit Hanun, which is a real hot spot. If, in fact, this negotiated pullout, that there are two schools of negotiations going on here. There is the talks with the Palestinian militants for a ceasefire, but also the Palestinian Authority, the government of Yasser Arafat and the new Prime Minister Abu Mazen, Mahmoud Abbas, is negotiating to assume security control in the Gaza and also in parts of the West Bank. It will happen first in this town of Beit Hanun that I visited yesterday, and boy, do they need relief. The sad thing is they may first taste the fruits of whatever peace comes, but I'm sorry to offer a bad wordplay, but they won't really see any fruit for 10 years because they've had 4,000 dunams of land uprooted. It's a citrus-growing area, and it's a moonscape. Israeli bulldozers have ripped out 4,000 dunams, that's 4 million square meters of fruit trees from the region, to clear sight lines so that they can keep an eye out for potential militants who might be moving into the area. The town has been decimated. I talked to a farmer yesterday who's replanting with little saplings their Valencia oranges. It will be 10 years before it bears fruit. And he said, I'm raising them like babies, but these are for my children. And he has four kids, and he's literally praying to God that these trees won't be uprooted, that they'll actually grow and live to bear fruit.
And that's his family's source of income, will be.
Right now, they're sustenance farming. They when their trees got uprooted, they started growing okra, watermelon, whatever little bits. They were exporters. This was an exporting region for oranges and lemons. But now they're just growing what they can. And, you know, it's a funny thing about refugees. The refugees began more than 50 years ago. And if you're designated as a refugee, it doesn't mean you necessarily live in a camp. If you're a Palestinian who wasn't a refugee, as designated by the UN, you don't have access to that aid. And so it's not just people living in camps versus people living in cities. Everybody is moved back and forth and in different places trying to have scrounged together a better life over the past 50 years. And so you can have neighbor living above the poverty line because he has UN refugee status, and another neighbor right next door who's just right on the edge.
Mitch Potter of the Toronto Star in Gaza City, who has been monitoring the ongoing efforts for peace in the Middle East. In the Middle East, Alston Beckett Cyrus. Two students from Oakland High School in California were questioned by the Secret Service on April 23rd after making disparaging statements about President Bush. The students were questioned without the presence of an attorney, and the school did not notify their parents for over 2 weeks. The students, both of Southeast Asian descent, claimed that the Secret Service threatened them and their families with deportation. Their crime? The students were alleged to have said, quote, Bush is whack, unquote. Peace Watch reporter Sarah Olson has more.
Oakland High School was one of many Bay Area schools that organized programs to help students deal with the prospect of a war with Iraq. The Oakland School District held a day-long teach-in to educate students against the war. Students participated in anti-war organizing efforts and held school-wide walkouts and in other ways contributed to the national dialogue about the pending war in Iraq. Larry Felsen teaches English and drama at Oakland High School.
Yeah, I think there was a lot of students who got involved in the activities, and I think at the same time it was controversial. You know, we had an administration that actually opposed the teach-in, and who opposed the teachers and the students who were taking part in it. And you had students who actually took part in walkouts around the war as well. And students were told they couldn't pass out leaflets. Students were advised that they might be suspended. During the walkout, the gates were locked at Oakland High, and leaflets were ripped up and torn up. So it was quite controversial.
On April 23rd, the Secret Service was called into Oakland High School after 10th grade English teacher Sandy Whitney notified them that two 16-year-old students, whose identity has not been released to the press, had made comments that she interpreted as threatening to the life of President George Bush. Amara Lynn is a volunteer youth organizer with Not In Our Name.
There was a discussion going on in a class about the war, and the teacher interpreted some of the comments to be threatening to the president and went to the police department, and they said, oh, this is not our jurisdiction, call the Secret Service. And so she did. And the Secret Service came in, pulled these students out of class, interrogated them. They didn't have any legal representation with them. You know, nobody had advised them any of their rights. Their parents weren't told that this even happened until like at least a week and a half after it happened. And when the families came to meet with the principal about the incident, they didn't have, there were no language appropriate translators available. And both students are of Southeast Asian descent.
While English teacher Sandy Whitney claims the students made threats against the president, the students themselves describe a much different scenario. Gen Fujioka is an attorney with the Asian Law Caucus and is representing the two students.
What is baffling about this case, and on one level is baffling, and another level is disturbing, is that it is very obvious to anyone that there was no real threat made to the life of the president by two students who are participating in a conversation, a discussion in class, and they make disparaging comments, apparently disparaging comments about the president. Or, and even that's subject to interpretation. If you think someone saying Bush is whacked as being a threat to the president, and it, I mean, it clearly shows disrespect to authority, but there's a big leap between, you know, drawing that interpretation and saying that you should call in the Secret Service.
The two students were visibly shaken by their experience. Cassie Lopez teaches Spanish and Ethnic Studies at Oakland High School. She said the students spoke with her about the incident the day after it happened.
These kids were targeted, and the end result was, you know, just a few days before school was out, one of the kids came in and just wept for about 15 minutes. He put his head in my lap in front of all the kids, and he cried. And he says, I can't be here anymore, you know. And, you know, that's irreparable damage, because the message is, you open up your mouth, you say something, you're going to get clobbered.
Activists claim that the situation is indicative of an environment at Oakland High School that was hostile to students speaking out against the pending war in Iraq. Amara Lynn of Not In Our Name.
This is not something that, for the students of Oakland High, is anything new. When the walkouts happened, people were passing out literature. They were told they couldn't pass out flyers. They were locked into their schools. The doors, the gates were chained shut. Students were assaulted by a security guard and told, you know, that they couldn't leave. And basically, the principal does not have a good track record of trying to support the students in asserting their voices and asserting their opinions.
The Oakland High School principal, Clement Mock, declined an interview for this story, but many have questioned his motives for allowing the Secret Service into Oakland High School. Gen Fujioka.
The principal has said that this is a case in which they were teaching the students that there was a line between what was appropriate speech and what was inappropriate speech, and that this was a, that their actions reflected, you know, the school's responsibility, quote, to teach having respect for authority in our leaders, unquote. That is what the principal has, how the principal has explained their conduct.
Teacher Cassie Lopez feels that Oakland High School should validate students and the questions that they have, rather than cracking down on their emergent voices.
Well, I think anybody involved in education knows that you're dealing with ideas. And I think our students need to know their ideas are valid. The questions they have are valid. It's valid to ask questions. It's valid to seek answers to things that we don't understand. In a lot of classrooms, kids had to read the newspapers, talk about the pros and the cons. But, you know, you were dealing with ideas. And I think it's important for our students to know that it's important to be able to ask those ideas and to seek for answers, whatever the answers might be. And I think that's what a school should do.
Many in the community have raised concerns about the treatment of the students while under Secret Service interrogation. Oakland High School teacher Larry Felsen.
According to what the students, reports about what the students said, that they, things like, that were said were things like, you know, we own you. You know, this is what the agents were saying to them. One of the kids asked if he could have a lawyer or if there was someone, an adult could be present. And he said, look, you know, you either talk to us now or we're, you know, going to put you in jail and you won't be able to talk to anybody for a long time. He says, we're not the police. This is the federal government, you know, and we own you.
Teacher Cassie Lopez says this type of intimidation is not appropriate, especially in an environment where immigrant communities are under increased attack.
The damage that was done to these children, because they were targeted, they are the children, first generation of immigrant background. You know, the message is you keep your mouth quiet, you don't say anything, you don't have an opinion, because you can't have an opinion.
Larry Felsen worries that this is part of a national trend in our country to stifle voices that question the government and its actions.
Anytime a student, like, says something against the government or against the president, they can expect a call from the Secret Service. I mean, this is a clear attempt to stifle dissent.
Amara Lynn of Not In Her Name has been working with youth in the Bay Area, but she sees youth across the country being targeted for their anti-war beliefs.
I think it's part of a larger trend, actually, that has sort of swept the nation. There are other schools, other students in other schools across the country who have either been told you have to go home, you can't wear a certain shirt, or, you can't have your anti-war club at our campus. You know, we're not going to allow that.
In San Francisco, I'm Sarah Olson.
Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is T from the Pattersons taking the train to Tibet. Our associate producer is Angelique Shofar. We had production assistance from Jim Bennett and Otto Hammett of KPFA, Keith Shaljian, Benta Berklin, and Ted Overman. Thanks to Pete Karakis, RadioForAll.net, and Shane Rock at WebActive.com for web help. If you'd like to support Peace Watch, we urge you to make a pledge through our secure online website at pacifica.org. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.